Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hi, welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 192. Today we're talking with Marco Wolf, an archaeologist, a student archaeologist from Germany, who I know personally from the project that I was just on in Ur. Marco, within about a week of leaving Ur to go to Lagash, my wife sent me along a blog post. I'm not sure how it ended up on her newsfeed, but it was from one of the editors of the Advances in Archaeological Practice, which is a journal that listeners of this podcast know Chris and I mine constantly for ideas and content. And the blog post is called "Looking Forward to the End of Digital Archaeology." And basically his premise is that, well, digital archaeology, the word digital doesn't add a whole lot to archaeology because everybody's doing something digitally nowadays. And that's something that we've said on the podcast, but we can't really let go of it either because Chris and I are both geeks and we both like a lot of computer and scientific and technical aspects of archaeology. But we have said that digital archaeology is maybe not it doesn't have the cachet that it used to. However, there are some people that do a lot of digital, so much so that the title probably still fits. And you, Marco, are somebody who is definitely a digital archaeologist, or at least an archaeologist who foregrounds the different kinds of digital work that you do. So I was wondering, and this is maybe an unfair question to lead off with, but I'll go for it anyhow, is do you consider yourself a digital archaeologist? And if so, why or why not?
Oh, difficult question.
Yeah.
To be honest, I would have said no in advance. For me, all the digital methods I use in the field, for me, were always part of field archaeology. Mm-hmm. When starting excavating in Germany, there was already lots of stuff where we had lots of digital methods. And when I was on my first abroad excavation in Kurdistan, we had a very, very digital workflow already with different kinds of GPS, total station, 3D modeling, and for me that was from the get-go, okay, that's how you do field archaeology. So it was never something different from the norm. So I would have said I'm just a normal field archaeologist.
No, that's totally fair. And that's kind of the point, I think, of this post, is that everybody uses digital tools now. And so, you know, when I was your age as an archaeologist, the fact that we were using total stations was pretty, you know, cutting edge. And now it's just expected that most projects are going to use them, even though, you know, I still love them. A few years ago, we had discussions on the podcast about photogrammetry, and now photogrammetry is just being done casually by pretty much everybody in the field. And yet, I definitely agree that how do you separate the digital from the archaeology with modern field workflows? But again, I am going to go back to the point that what I saw from you in the field at Ur was somebody who definitely foregrounds those digital tools over, or maybe not necessarily over, but definitely brings them up at least to a level of other less digital, more analog kinds of tools, and the digging and the drawing and the kinds of things that we've done for 100+ years as archaeologists. So before I go down this rabbit hole too deep, can you tell us on Ur the kinds of digital tools that you were using to help us with the excavation?
Yeah, in Ur, of course, we started with the total station. Mm-hmm. Since it's the backbone of every modern archaeology, you have the setup of your measurements, your GIS system, and everything you find must be located at some point. Mm-hmm. So that's for me always the backbone, and there it starts. Other than that, methods I use, there's lots of photogrammetry in the field, since I'm a big fan of the option to look back at stuff you may have not seen while excavating, but now when you have the model, you have still the option to get some information, not all information, but looking back on it, you may see some stuff, you know, color grading, getting contrast and stuff like that. So for that, use photogrammetry with normal mirrorless camera or with a drone to get the whole trench in one model. Other than that, we also use the photogrammetry back at the off, back in the house when 3D modeling. Small finds we thought were interesting enough to have them as 3D objects, which then can later be processed in many ways for drawings, getting sections of it, comparing them in size with other objects, or just trying to get a better understanding on the technique, how it was made.
Right. So the photogrammetry, definitely, that was one of the things that impressed me, that you were using photogrammetry quite a bit. And again, a lot of people are using photogrammetry on different projects, but you're using it in both of the major ways that people are using it. You're using it for documentation of the trench of the excavation and for documentation of the objects that were coming out with different setups. Do you mind describing a little bit the different setups that you personally were using?
Yes. In the field, there is no real setup. It's just taking pictures, making sure, and with now some years of experience, having an idea how to take pictures and what to be careful of when taking pictures, how is the shadow casted, always making sure that all the stuff you gone from the place, so that not, how you say, when you're taking a model of your trench and then you see, oh God, I forgot that there's a brush lying on top of the wall, and now that brush is in the 3D model, that looks not professional, stuff like that. And that's for the field. And what I think you want to talk about is my setup in the house for the small finds, where I had like a photo box cube with LED lights inside, where I put a turntable, just a rather cheap one you can find everywhere. They use it normally for advertisement when they put it up in their windows and put the stuff they want to sell on top of it, so it turns a little bit and looks very nice. And I use that turntable to put on the objects, and then while they turn in a very slow pace, I just press my camera and just take lots of pictures from different angles, which then get meshed together for a dense cloud and 3D model. The process afterwards.
You said that the ones in the field you're using for documentation, and that oftentimes you see things post facto in the models that you've made, you know, soil colors, various kinds of things that are highlighted that might not always show up immediately in the field while you're, you know, covered in dirt and sweat and digging, but that you can catch them later when you have a little more time. Do you notice the same sort of thing happen with the artifacts that you do photogrammetric models of?
For me, I realized when already while taking the pictures of objects or of structures in the field, I'm trying to get all the details. So I'm getting more focused on the details.
Mm.
So already while taking the pictures, I realize stuff and see stuff and like, that's interesting. Or that's something I just now realized. And then later, especially when taking the big models for the trench and you have the top view and can see the whole trench from above, you can see lots of stuff you cannot see in the field since you're already standing right on top of it. And on the small finds also, you get especially the very, very, very small ones where, you can just see with the blank eye, but when it's in 3D, you can zoom in to millimeters, nanometers, so you can get all the details you can never see with only the eye. For example, cylinder seals, which can be like 2 centimeters tall, and then you have this model on your computer and you can zoom in so it fills the whole screen. So of course you see all the different stuff and the detail they put into creating those small objects.
And that's very interesting to me. Chris and I go back and forth because Chris would always like, you know, some kind of a scanner that you could just boop and have an object or soil or site or whatever just photographed, essentially documented in extreme detail. And I always like the human element especially of drawing, because that forces you to stop and look and evaluate what's important, what's salient about something, whether it's a section drawing or an object drawing, pottery profile, whatever. And what you're saying here, and I hadn't considered it, though I should have, is that the very careful photogrammetric work is kind of bridging that gap. It's not relying on the automation of the machine, but you are stopping and thinking, how am I going to, what's important about this? How am I going to make it show up in the photogrammetry? You're actually balancing those two kinds of approaches, the automation of the machines with the more manual approach of traditional drawing. I'm going to actually think about that one for a while, because that's a benefit that I hadn't considered before. So, that's why I wanted you on, because the fact that you are, such a digitally focused in terms of the methods that you approach your archaeology without separating them out as their own special thing means that you've come at these tools in a slightly different perspective than I have. I mean, it's an age thing, right? I remember when we got our first flatbed scanner. That was pretty cool. But it's born digital or not born digital, but I guess for cohorts of archaeologists. So anyhow, that ability to slow down to do the work as opposed to speed up to do the digital work, which is what people tend to focus on, is an interesting perspective. I hadn't thought about that before. Are there a particular set of tools that you like best? Are there certain ones that you gravitate to?
You mean it's in specifically with photogrammetry or?
No, in general, just archaeology. And it could even be analog tools. It could be the trowel for all I care. I'm just kind of curious that you managed to squeeze something out of the photogrammetric work that I hadn't considered. So I'm wondering if there's a general approach that you have, a general set of tools that just tickle your fancy to use.
The difficult question. For me, what I found for myself is the camera, to be completely honest, which I take not only the photogrammetry, but also the excavation photography. And I realized for myself, when comparing myself with colleagues or even on project with other colleagues on the same trend, how much more pictures I take than anyone else, because I always have the fear that later when I try to present what I did in the field, I have not a perfect image. I was like, I'm sitting there and say, oh, why did I not take any picture of that and not from this perspective? Why is that wall only photographed from the north and not from the south? So I'm a huge fan of cameras, always trying to get being up to date, what is now the best setup to use, where you have to be careful, which data type for images is most long-lived and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I was checking to set up my own setup, always better getting newer lenses, checking if there's maybe a possibility to update my case to with a higher resolution, stuff like that. So if you ask me like that, I would say the camera is my favorite digital tool.
No, well, I think that a lot of archaeologists would agree with you. And again, the born digital thing, I started my photography journey with film. And so it's hard for me to get over the idea of, oh, well, I can only take the one perfect photo. I can take the 100 photos and 3 of them are going to be perfect if I use digital, a digital camera as opposed to the film camera. But anyhow, let's take a break right here, because what you just mentioned about taking all those photos, I've got a few follow-up questions for you.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, welcome back to the Architect Podcast, episode 192, segment 2. Marco, just before we went to break there, you were talking about photography and taking way more pictures than anybody else takes, just as out of a fear of missing data, which makes a lot of sense. But it does bring up to me another aspect of digital archaeology that a lot of people don't have a very good grasp on. So I'm kind of curious what you do. How do you manage your data? What do you do with all those photographs you take and with all the other different kinds of digital data that you generate, the photogrammetric models, the magnetograms, whatever else?
Very good question, because that's always the main issue during excavation. For example, in Ur, I started now to have like an external SSD hard drive with me, with 2 terabytes Thunderbolt connection, so I can work in as fast as possible with the data and can upload all my data onto that hard drive, and having all the information on one drive and not having the issue of loading it onto my computer, uploading it on a backup drive, and then not always being sure, is everything on the backup or have I forgot something? Because at some point, the hard drive on my laptop, at least for the moment, is limited and has lots of stuff in it. So I cannot put all the information of a project on there. So I'm always trying to make, always looking on ways for organizing data. What I try to do is, for example, for the photogrammetry, I start for the photogrammetry, it's always best to use raw data, as, which is then transversed into a TIFF or a DNG, which I use in my workflow. There's different workflows and everyone has their own opinion about it. But for me, I personally like to use DNG images for photogrammetry. And after I did that, I try to I delete JPEGs. I do not take for photogrammetry because I don't need that. So I just skipped over those. When taking them to check if the model does work, if I have not time to fully render it, and when I know, okay, it works, I delete the JPEGs to get more space. From the point of view how to manage, it's always in how in order them, and always making sure that only the data I need is in the same file. Corresponding of obvious ways is to compress the data, of course, to make it more manageable. And what I also do is to rename the different data files with abridged and stuff, to make always sure when I find like a single find that is kind of lost, I'm always knowing, it originally belongs there.
And do you have a rigid naming scheme or file structure that you use for saving all your various kinds of data?
Depending on the project, the way the project wants me to digitize the data, the way how they use the date system, year, month, day, or stuff like that, and where I am. But normally it's always like I put the date first, the place where I am, and I always for each picture, when I'm working, when, for example, in Ur, each individual picture got an own number. I've had a list, Excel sheet, where each photography was listed, when was taken, what was seen in the image, what was the original file name when it was transferred from the SD card, and what is its name now.
Wow. That's pretty extensive.
To always be sure that when something comes up or when I'm searching for something, I always have a list of seeing where is it, when did I take it. And the Excel sheet is then there's the possibility to upload the CSV data up to a database if that is needed. And I also have my own data system where I can upload all those data sheets.
And then how do you transfer all this data and the Excel sheet metadata to the dig director or whoever needs to assemble it?
That depends on how the dig director wants it to have. In Ur, mm-hmm. for example, I just gave him the Excel sheet. So he has the information just in Excel and he can use it how he needs it. Some cases we were talking in advance when the database was fully set up at some excavations, I optimized my list, my Excel sheet, the way so I can upload it perfectly to this database mm-hmm. so that they have all the information I seem necessary for the documentation in the setup they prepared in advance.
And the photographs themselves, I mean, if they have the Excel sheet but they don't have access to the photographs, how do you get the photographs to them?
That's also something in my workflow. Each day there's a backup. Everything I do, every report I write, every image I take, every model I work on is uploaded on a backup drive, which will then be brought on the same day to the field director, which then does a backup for himself.
Oh, perfect. So then just, yes, you do have this very structured approach that you repeat across different projects, which I think is fantastic. I think that people need to do that they, you know, trying to reinvent how they're going to store files for every project is a non-starter. It's a way of losing data. How much time do you end up spending just managing your data at the end of the day when you're in the field? And how much of that spills over to after the field work? Or do you get everything done day by day?
Normally, when in the field, after coming back from excavation, most of the day is then set up in managing the data. It always depends on how much produced during the day. You know it as well. There are some days where it's kind of boring. There's some pottery collections brought in and maybe one or two pictures. So there's not much to work afterwards. But in some days, especially on the last week where you want to finish everything and be sure that you documented everything, there's lots of stuff coming in. I remember on my Ur, for example, you know, the last example, on my last day where I finished the documentation, I took 120 images, excavation photographs, mm-hmm. to document the situation at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. And all those have to be renamed, put into my Excel sheet, have to be described, and giving all the information I believe was necessary. So mm-hmm. On those days, it took me a long time, but normally I always finish on the very day itself. Also with mm-hmm. writing reports and stuff, normally I'm always on day, can always finish the whole documentation that needs to be done on the day, on the same day, and having nothing I have to work afterwards, except for photogrammetry. Especially the small fines photogrammetry sometimes takes a little more work, since sometimes there's issues with noise in the dense cloud, which have to be deleted and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. the nearer you get to the end of the excavation, you have no time for such detailed work. So you say you take the images, you make sure that you can render a model with those images, but you bring them back home and then work with them back at home. But the field reports and the images and my descriptions of small finds and the like will always be done on the same day. In some cases, maybe shift on to the next day, but then try to never carry work longer than 2 days. And it normally gets even.
That's good. That takes a lot of discipline to do it like that. But I think I think that's the appropriate way to work with one's data as much as one can. I mean, you know, illness and other unexpected things always crop up in the field, but if you have a system like that in place, that really I think helps in the long run. I'm going to switch gears here, because after I left Ur, I went up to Lagash and did a number of different projects there that I was working on, but the new one that I was working on was magnetometry. Listeners to the podcast would have heard me talking about that on the last episode. After Ur, you went down to Uruk to do magnetometry. And you're much more experienced in magnetometry than I am. I want our listeners to know. Mm-hmm. But can you tell them a little bit what you're doing there, how much you've worked with magnetometry in the past? Just give us a little overview of what you were doing when you went to Uruk.
Yeah, experience-wise, maybe in taken when I started compared to you. But I'm also just still at learning stuff. For when I learned back in 2017, my second year of studying, there was a class where they showed us pretty much every geophysical prospection method, from magnetometry to GPR, ERT, and stuff like that, which we can use in the field. How does that work technically? As much as we could understand that with no further background of the physics, and what are the problems with that. And there I met Professor Jörg Fassbender from Munich, who is professor here at the university, or still giving classes. And he is a professor for geophysics, and he's working with archaeologists since, I believe, the 1980s, doing magnetometry prospection pretty much everywhere. And he's always in search of students, especially from the archaeologists, that he can take in the field to teach them and to have assistance. And yeah, I was lucky enough that he brought me with him. And since 2018, I regularly with him at least once a year on a prospection everywhere. We went to Russia when that was still an option, to Uzbekistan, Tajikistan. Lots of times we were in Iraq, in Georgia, stuff like that. Always working with total field magnetometers. And this year we went in the second half of November, we went to Uruk as part of a project with the German Archaeological Institute, where we try to add to the magnetometry data Jörg already put up in the years since 2001. So he already started this project back in the early 2000s, which then had to stop, and is now back since 2016. And every year he tries to be now down there to add up and trying to get the whole mound prospected, which is with 500 hectare. I don't know what's in acres.
Beast.
It's enormous. And now after, I don't know, now 7 years or seven prospection campaigns, we're at 1/3 maybe. A little bit less, so it takes a lot of time. And this year we came back to get more data about the lower city in the northwest of Uruk, since from the city itself we know lots about the holy buildings at the center of the city, which were excavated since the early 1900s by mostly German archaeologists. But we do not know anything about the structure of the canals or the houses of the normal people, when you want to say it like that, that built all those huge temples. And that was what we are interested in, to understand the layout of the city, if there's roads that are set up in advance, or is it a city that was kind of grew with time. And the channels in itself, we are very interested in waterway systems of the ancient Near East, and that's what we are mostly focused right now. So we wanted to get as much of this main channel that comes from the north and goes down on the west side of the city.
Well, fascinating. I have some follow-up questions for you, but why don't we take a little break here and I'll ask you them on the other side.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 192, final segment for today. Marco, right at the end there, you were talking about doing magnetometry at Uruk. And I can't recall, did you also do the magnetometry with Dr. Fassbinder at Ur as well?
No, unfortunately not. That project was still with other colleagues. In that time, I was at a different project.
Mm-hmm.
I know the data, but I was not part of collecting it.
Right. No, I was just curious because, as you well know, there are stakes, wooden stakes from that project all over the site. And Dr. Adelheid Otto, the project that she was working on in conjunction with ours, was excavating a large house kind of on the outer part of the city, not a lower tell, just the outer edge of the main tell. And that, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that was found in that magnetometry, or initially identified in that magnetometry, and then they've been excavating it since.
Yes, Dr. Otto is huge fan of the prospection method to first get an understanding or more information, and then judging with that data and other data like satellite images or drone images, mm-hmm. where to start excavating.
Yeah, we've been doing the same at Lagash, and I think that a lot of people are bringing these same kind of suite of tools for Iraq, magnetometry, drone imagery, satellite imagery, old aerial imagery, spy photos and the like. It seems to be a really rich vein to tap.
Yes, exactly. And especially in Ur, there was, for example, the trench I was supervising at the east mound of Ur was mm-hmm. also chosen because of the magnetometry, which was done there right. in 2019.
And how closely did the magnetometry cue to what you found when you were actually digging?
It was rather good. I was rather surprised because the yard we could see in the magnetometry was exactly where we found it in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting, because the difference from the magnetometry, you could see, okay, there's walls that make us pretty much rectangular or square unit, which is pretty large, 5 meters in each direction, 5 by 4.5 meters.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the huge, you could see perfectly, okay, that's the wall and that's the inside. But when we were excavating it, we realized that the floor of the yard was laid out with baked bricks as well. So technically, we should have not seen that the difference because it's the same material.
Uh-huh.
But since it was so deep, it did not show up in the magnetic image.
How deep was that? Because I'm actually asking you this professionally, not for the podcast.
Yeah.
But at Lagash, we're dealing with very, very little baked brick. It's almost entirely just unbaked mud brick, as opposed to Ur, where there's such a quantity of baked brick. How much deeper was that floor than the walls?
The walls, compared to the highest level of bricks we could find, we had 70 centimeters difference.
Oh, wow.
So okay. We had like 7 to 8 layers of bricks before we hit mm-hmm. the floor, which was laid with baked bricks as well.
And no indication then that courtyard was paved in the magnetograms?
No. In the magnetometry, we could see each room individually since the walls in comparison. So from my point of view, I was like, okay, that's all mud floor. I have to be careful mm-hmm. not to dig right through it. But then we suddenly hit the baked bricks. And I was like, ah.
Well, that's fortunate because I dig through mud floors all the time.
I was like, oh,
I see them in section. I'm like, oh, yeah, that was the floor that I missed. And yeah. There's the other floor that I missed. And there's the floor I missed before that.
Yeah, and I was trying to be very careful. And then we hit the floor and was like, oh, I did not have to be that careful. But well.
Well, that's fortunate. That's interesting, though, that it showed up differently with that 70 centimeters. I'm not surprised, but I am surprised. I wanted to actually switch gears again here a little bit. Early on in the project, where you were working was on what we're calling the East Tell, which is a smaller outlying tell of the main mound of Ur. And we were having some troubles with the total stations and with the registration of our survey stations. So there was a day there that we were working, you and I were working, shooting between two of our survey stations, one on that East Tell and one up on the main mound, back and forth, about 400 meters. And after about the third time you had to go there, back and forth between these two mounts, I offered to go instead of you. I said, you know, you're walking too much. And you said, oh no, I'm used to walking. You know, I do geophysics. And like, okay, also you're young, but sure, you do geophysics, therefore you're used to walking. It makes a lot of sense. So you don't just do magnetometry when you do geophysics. You'd mentioned ERT. Is there a particular kind of geophysical prospection that you personally enjoy doing most?
In that case, I would have to say the magnetometry, because that's what I mostly do, or mainly. The ERT I used only 3 to 4 times. We're now going to use it again in February when we're back in the field. But mostly magnetometry, because for me, it's always fun to be in the field the whole day, walking and sweating, and then come back at the end of the day, processing the data and having an image at the end of the day you can see, and you can see what you did and what you found. And that's always so, yeah, you can see so much more comparable to archaeological dig where you're sitting in a 10 by 10 meter trench for 5 weeks, and then you have parts of a house excavated in geophysics and magnetometry. You have 1 day and you have a whole, you have like 50, 60 houses to lay out.
Right. No, I get that. I was definitely getting that same sense when I was doing the magnetometry at Lagash, where, you know, I spend an hour and I do my 45 by 45 and afterwards I process it and I look at it and it's like, oh my goodness, that's what I was just walking over. Look at this. I could kind of sense this. One of the things that I found fascinating was trying to correlate things that we saw on the surface with things that we'd pick up in the magnetometry. And then, of course, you know, a step removed, things that we'd find in the excavation. Do you find a lot of correlation between soil stains or, you know, any other kind of surface visible feature and your magnetometry? Is that common?
Yes, of course. When you're walking and you're on the field, you're always checking, what can I see? And the most stuff, you only have the soil. So you're checking, can I see differences in the color? And I remember in Georgia, we had a huge acre and you could see, okay, there's multiple dots with very bright brown color. And we were sure, there must be the mud bricks. And when we were walking above them and then checked back and said, ah, yeah, that's the big houses, so like 2 to 3 meter big walls. And like, yeah, that's, we could see on the, when we were walking on top of it. But I can also give the opposite example for it, because in the, you know it as well, in southern Iraq, where these ancient cities, where there are some cases where you can even see the old houses while walking on top of them, because the bricks are showing from the surface. And when we are walking with the magnetometry above them, there are some cases where the layers of the bricks, it's like only 1 or 2 layers of bricks left of that wall, which is so near to the surface that you cannot see it in the magnetometry, or only a small shadow of it. And you were like, but I was walking on the obvious houses. Why did they not show up in the magnetometry? So there's also cases like that, but those are very, very, yeah, they're not, they're very rare. In most cases, if you see something while walking, it always correlates with the data you collect. We, for example, also have a workflow where when we come back, we make sketches, and the squares we walked, we make notes about not only what we could see on the surface from the structures, but also from pottery and tools.
Yeah.
If we could see, okay, there's pottery from this period, or from this period, we can see that there is lots of flint tools and stuff like that. We always note that, since that is also very, very important in related steps of the interpretation.
To round this out, in addition to being, well, not a digital archaeologist, because you already said no, but a student archaeologist who does geophysics and uses a lot of digital methods, I know that from discussions with you, I know that during the off seasons, back home in Germany, you work as a contract archaeologist. Can you give us a sense of what that is? Do you get to use a lot of these same tools, or is the regulatory structure in Germany such that you have to use different methods, maybe older methods? Because that's a problem that we bump into sometimes in the US.
Yes. When back in Germany, I'm contracted as a student worker for a company, an archaeological company, that is excavating mostly in the area around Munich. We have no real scientific excavations where we apply for money and start working, but we are getting called by people that are building their houses or construction sites that want to build a supermarket and stuff, and for them to check if there is any archaeology where they're building their stuff, and which we are as excavating so that they can continue with their work. And the way how we do that work is supervised and set in stone by the Bavarian Department for Cultural Heritage, which give in irregular terms, they give us a book where the way how we have to excavate, what kind of data we have to collect, which we have to present them. And that is, how you say, a little bit behind what is now kind of normal, or it's already in use in field archaeology from universities, museums, and institutes. I remember until 2017, we still had to use non-digital cameras with film to document the features in addition to the digital ones. And they only changed that in 2017 because they realized that in the long run, there will be no more film since then. it's a form of the only company, Fujifilm, said that they will rapidly shorten their production of those. And then it was clear, okay, in the long run, those analog cameras without digital and formats will just be, will be gone forever. So they kind of like, okay, then we should.
Right. So the choice in their case was forced by external factors.
Yeah.
Do you get a sense that there's an ability, maybe not as a student archaeologist, but is there an ability to change, to adopt more new methods from within, or is everything have to be forced from externally, like the abandonment of film?
No, no. The department is always in search of new methods, trying to optimize their workflow. But a main issue about that is the way how who has to pay for that. Because everything the department says that has to be done has to be paid by the people building the houses, which in some cases, if they get way overboard and say every millimeter has to be in 3D and stuff like that, and it takes lots of work hours, lots of people, all the private people have to pay for that. So they try to get a perfect balance between how much do we actually need on data to later, if because to have later the option to really analyze that, and how much can we ask the people to pay for that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Marco, it's been a pleasure talking to you again. I really enjoyed working with you, and I hope I get the chance to again. And for our listeners, it's approaching, no, it's after 1 a.m. for you now. So I really appreciate your taking the time to come on here and talk with us. And I hope that that some of our listeners find what you had to say interesting. And you know, I hope that other students find what you say interesting, because I thought that the way that you're negotiating the contract archaeology, the academic archaeology, the digital archaeology, the geophysics, and all these again was a very interesting and well-rounded approach. And that's why I wanted you on here. So I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It was already so nice to speak with you again. And if there's an option to come back, I'm glad to be back.
Wonderful. Well, take care. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for listening to the ArchaeoTech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.archpodnet.com/ArchaeoTech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugal.com. Support the show by becoming a member at archpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Come.